Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran has responded to Israel right inside Tel Aviv whenever it's decided to. Fears are growing of the Russia-Ukraine war spreading to neighboring countries as Belarus saying it's downed several Ukrainian missiles. North Korea says that the U.S. only wants to attain military supremacy over the Asia-Pacific by hopping up the threat posed by Pyongyang. It's good to have you with us. The Syrian president has hailed Iran as part of the solution to problems in the region as he met with Iranian foreign minister in Damascus. Bashar al-Assad said that collective regional efforts are needed to resolve regional problems. Noted that Damascus welcomes any solution that would keep Syria away from war. The Iranian minister also condemned Israeli violations of Syria's territorial integrity. Amir Abdullahian said the silence of Western countries, which claim to advocate human rights, exposes their double standard. Regarding Turkey's plan to launch a military operation inside Syria, the Iranian foreign minister said that his country understands Turkey's security concerns, but is opposed to any form of military action in the Arab country.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. They discussed cooperation relations in which Assad described ties between both states as an alliance of will in the face of Western hegemony. During the meeting, the Syrian president touched upon the threats of Turkey to launch a new offensive in Syria. Assad said Turkish pretexts for an aggression on Syria are false, misleading, and disconnected from reality, stressing that they violate the UN Charter and international law. Amir Abdullahian said Assad's recent visit to Tehran constituted a turning point in Syrian-Iranian relations. He added that Israeli attacks on Syria are part of the terrorist war on the country. The top Iranian official noted that Iran is ready to help settle misunderstandings between Damascus and Ankara.
Any foreign intervention in Syria complicates the situation. We understand Turkish concerns over border issues. The solution lies in dialogue between Syrian and Turkish security officials. I understand from my talks with the Turks that they prioritize a political solution.
Amir Abdullahian also had a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. He expressed optimism over solving the Turkish-Syrian conflict peacefully, asserting Iran will exert all efforts to prevent any conflict in Syria. Maqdad welcomed Iran's efforts.
Any solution that leads to Turkey's retreat from Syrian territories, stopping its attacks on the country, and ending Turkey's support to terrorist groups is welcomed. We trust the Islamic Republic of Iran, but not the other side.
Maqdad reiterated Syria's determination to eliminate terrorism and thanked Iran for its support. He stressed that Israel must realize that Syria will not remain silent over Israeli aggressions.
The visit shows the depth of ties between the two allies and the crucial role Iran plays in the region, as it comes hours after an Israeli attack on Syria and amid speculations that Turkey is going to launch a military operation in the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
On the sidelines of his visit to Damascus, the Iranian foreign minister also sat down with leaders of Palestinian groups based in Syria. There, Hossein Amir Abdullahian emphasized Iran's capability to respond to the Tel Aviv regime inside Tel Aviv.
We have responded to the Zionist regime right inside Tel Aviv whenever we have wanted to.
Amir Abdullahian said that Tel Aviv's allegations that Iran is seeking to target Israeli tourists in Turkey is nothing but a fabricated scenario. He said that Palestine remains the most pressing issue of the Muslim world. The minister stressed Iran's unflinching support for Palestinians until the liberation of their homeland and the establishment of the state of Palestine with Al-Quds as its capital. He regretted that certain regional states are turning a blind eye to the issue of Palestine and getting closer to Israel to cover up their domestic issues. Amir Abdullahian said that is a betrayal of the cause of Palestine. Well, it's been 15 years since Press TV was launched. The platform says it wants to be a voice for the voiceless and has tried to be an alternative for the vast and wealthy mainstream media corporations. 15 years on, Press TV is standing tall despite multiple attempts made to shut the channel down, be it online or on air.
To try to provide a different narrative against what is produced by the mainstream media is not an easy job. That's what Press TV has been trying to do all along. The coverage of issues like the Israeli regime's daily atrocities in the occupied Palestine, U.S. war crimes in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, and the U.S.-backed Saudi war in Yemen, and the very fact that the hypocrisy on the part of the so-called mainstream media has brought Press TV on the wrong side of many people.
I think Press TV had a huge amount of success, certainly in the early years. Of course, they've faced a lot of pushback. Of course, the Zio Western media controls satellites. It controls a lot of the media output. So in more recent years, of course, there's been a tacit campaign, a concerted campaign, to try and stop Press TV being able to get as far as it could. YouTube have been involved. Many of the sat channels, which are owned by Murdoch over here in the West, also turned on them. But nonetheless, there is a real substantial audience of Press TV which is picking up those lives and then sharing it across social media.
Press TV has faced hardships and bans since the very first days of its launch. Perhaps the most notable of such bans was in June 2021 when the channel's web domain was seized by the United States. In fact, by shutting down Press TV, the U.S. decided for 1.4 billion English-speaking people on the planet that they can no longer watch and listen to news that goes against the U.S. narrative.
Press TV has faced bans on numerous occasions in the past years. Its Facebook page, with more than 4 million followers, was arbitrarily removed. Its entire YouTube channel was deleted and banned from using Google services. And in 2012, it was taken off air in UK by the country's media regulator, Ofcom.
But why is it that a platform like Press TV faces so many restrictions? A recent poll by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism paints a grim picture for the mainstream media. Not only they are losing their viewership, but their viewers also trust them less.
Trust in news is also declining and is lowest in the United States. On average, 42% of people said they trust most news most of the time.
Such news is not good news for the mainstream media, of course. People tend to turn to other sources of information that offer a different narrative, such as Press TV.
So the reality is that the Western media has played an absolutely diabolical role in terms of its kind of balanced reporting on West Asia as a whole. So not only Palestine, but Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Iran, that whole region. Western media has essentially been part of the terrorism that has been wrought on the entire region by Western imperialist military forces. The media in the West has really ridden shotgun and supplemented the psychological operations aspect of whatever they wanted to do in that region. What they want to do is obviously to subjugate the Yemenis, subjugate the Iraqis, subjugate everybody in that region to continue to maintain their hold on energy resources and various other geopolitical interests.
To get a glimpse of just how different Press TV is from other mainstream media, one can look at an open letter signed by more than 2,000 Canadian journalists last year about how biased their media is towards Israel.
Anyone who has worked in a Canadian newsroom has encountered the reluctance or resistance in covering Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Canadian style guides still ban the use of the word Palestine in their coverage.
After publishing the letter, some journalists even published another letter saying they fear retaliation over publicly discussing such matters. In a world where mainstream media even censors their own journalists for using the word Palestine, it is no wonder that a platform like Press TV has faced so many hurdles and bans.
Moving on, Belarus warning neighboring Ukraine against carrying out provocative acts. It says that Ukrainian forces fired missiles toward its territory. President Alexander Lukashenko says his forces intercepted several missiles from the direction of Ukraine around 3 days ago. Intense fighting, meantime, is underway in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces are inching closer to the capture of Lysychansk. Kiev has conceded that the city could soon fall. Ukraine's last remaining bastion, Lugansk, is located across the river from Severodonetsk. That's another major city that fell to Russians just last week. But Lysychansk and their hands, Russian troops will be able to move further into the Donbass region. Meantime, in the Russian border city of Belgorod, three people have been killed and several others wounded in blasts. According to local officials, dozens of apartments and private homes have been damaged or destroyed. No reaction from Kiev. All right, from Donetsk, let's bring in our correspondent, Jana Miller. He's been there looking closely at all what's happened there. Jana, good to have you with us. Tell us about this fear of war that Belarus is talking about may spread to other countries around Ukraine, and also an update on how the battle is going on around Lysychansk.
Well, it looks like Russia has taken Lysychansk. It was expected. It was only a matter of time. It's happened very, very quickly as Ukrainian forces have retreated to the next town they hope to defend in Sversk. So the Russians very much going forward. Some say that Ukraine cannot win the battle for Donbass. It's only a matter of time until, and a matter of many lives until Russia is able to take the rest of Donbass, but it still may take many weeks or even months of fighting. But the most interesting news today is this Ukrainian attack on civilians in Belgorod in Russia. Now, the Ukrainians are playing a very dangerous game here by hitting civilians on Russian territory. A few weeks ago, Vladimir Putin warned that if Ukraine attack the Russian attack Russia, particularly with NATO weapons, then Russia will respond with devastating force, in particular hitting the decision-making centers in Kiev. Now, if you were to travel as a citizen to Kiev tomorrow, you'd be hard-pressed to find any damage there. There hasn't been many strikes by Russia in Kiev. You wouldn't even perhaps know there was a war going on. But Russia has not hit many targets in Kiev, particularly the decision-making center, so the presidential office, government ministries, partly because it still wants to negotiate with Ukraine. It doesn't want to damage the chance of negotiations too much by destroying too much of Ukrainian cities. But if Ukraine continue to attack Russian territory, Russia will respond. Now, I've seen that this attack in Belgorod may well have been a Tochiku missile, which isn't a NATO-supplied weapon. But Russia will respond regardless. And if Ukraine want to play this game of attacking Russian cities, Russia, with its arsenal of missiles, is only going to be one winner in terms of causing damage to Ukrainian cities. So we'll have to see in the coming hours whether Russia does respond to these attacks. But if Ukraine does continue to strike Russian territory, Russia will respond with attacking Ukrainian cities, most likely. So that could be an escalation of the war. We might find out in the coming hours or coming days whether that happens.
Okay, and Johnny, we haven't heard any reaction from Kiev regarding this Russian border city that was hit, and there have been several casualties. Have you heard any? And also about Lysychansk, what it would mean if it falls to Russia?
Yeah, I haven't seen any response yet from Kiev. It's interesting that Kiev does have a tactic of shelling civilian areas. In Donetsk, well, shelling here has mostly stopped, but for weeks and for years, indeed, Ukraine had targeted and shelled civilians. And that seems to be what it's doing in Belgorod as well. It doesn't see much military, the purpose of targeting and shelling civilians. In Donetsk, Ukraine does that in order to try and terrorize the population, try and stop them supporting the pro-Russian fighters here that have been fighting for years against the Ukrainian nationalists. Attacking Russian cities may well be an attempt to push the Russian population against the war and against Putin. Because Putin is very popular in Russia, the war is very popular in Russia, so it may well have that, may well achieve that aim. Of course, this will be big news in Russia, Ukraine hitting Russian civilians. Or it could have the opposite effect of making the Russian people more angry at Ukraine. Indeed, there's many people, important politicians in Russia, who are asking, have been asking for some time for Putin to start hitting these decision-making centers in Kiev. So we'll have to see what happens there. And in terms of Lyshansk, as I said, it looks like Russia has taken or almost taken Lyshansk. That was expected to happen very quickly. It has happened very quickly. And now they'll be moving on to the next small city called Seversk. There's been reports that Ukraine is trying to set up defensive positions there. But as I said, it's very hard for them with the Russian air and artillery superiority to even stop the Russian army. But it's in cities that Ukraine have the best chance of holding up the Russian army, and that's where their next defensive line will be.
Okay, thanks a lot for that, John Miller, our correspondent, Donetsk, Ukraine.
Thank you.
North Korea is expressing concerns about a U.S., South Korea, and Japan planning to build a military alliance similar to NATO in the region. According to the Foreign Ministry, Washington's allegations about a threat coming from North Korea are nothing but an excuse to attain military supremacy over the Asia-Pacific region. The official says that is why Pyongyang needs to urgently build up its defenses to cope with a rapidly worsening security situation. Leaders of the United States, South Korea, and Japan met on the sidelines of a NATO summit last week. At that meeting, they pledged to work together on an extended deterrence against North Korea. In Australia, thousands of residents of Sydney will have to leave their homes as flooding hits the southeastern parts of the city. Some 200 millimeters of rain has been recorded in many areas. Local dams and rivers are starting to spill. The Weather Bureau is warning of a serious risk of flash floods and landslides. Officials are asking people to avoid unnecessary travels. The government says that emergency services and military troops are on standby to help people. The rainfall will continue for at least the next 2 days. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we saw that more than 50 countries have depleted uranium weapons. These weapons have been used extensively by U.S. and NATO forces during the past three decades, namely in Iraq and the Balkans. The consequences for both military personnel and civilians have proven to be tragic. Yet despite the evidence, the military industry and nuclear authorities continue to downplay the dangers. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the program.
Our soldiers on peace missions in the Balkans are said to have been contaminated due to the presence of depleted uranium in the munitions.
My friends, we have with us Sergeant Major Antonacci. Unfortunately, you're ill. Could you tell us how this came about?
I left on August the 31st, 1998, for a six-month mission. I got the go-ahead after medical checks. During my stay in Sarajevo, I suffered several faint and dizzy spells. And a few months after I came back, these were attributed to lymphoma.
Cancer?
In Florence, I meet General Fabio Migni. In 2002, he takes command of the NATO mission in Kosovo. He's immediately concerned by the risks involved with depleted uranium, following NATO strikes in the area in 1999.
My chain of command, formed by an American admiral in Naples and the supreme Allied commander in Brussels, stood by the official directives and reports, including those drawn up by scientists in the US. I was therefore frequently confronted with this type of response. It's true, Fabio. You're right to be worried, but we have reports which say that there's no problem. And from a military point of view, we can't bypass them to do things that go beyond what is asked of us, and which could even prevent us from accomplishing our mission. So it was recommended that we reiterate and support among the civil population the fact that it wasn't a grave danger, that it was quite normal. And to say to the military, especially the engineer corps, treat the depleted uranium munitions like any other type of munitions. But a grenade is not the same thing as a depleted uranium projectile. I'll tell you something. In 2007, I was treated for a tumor in my colon. I never wondered if it was because of the year I spent in Kosovo. But I'll always have doubts. I still have a doubt today that it was perhaps due to that.
Politicians in Rome are mobilized, as is the government. For the first time, without waiting for definitive scientific confirmation, a law recognizes the danger of depleted uranium. When Arturo Parisi is appointed Minister of Defense in 2006, the case is one of his first preoccupations.
Our concern is that the suffering, the pain, the injuries, deaths, and damage should never go beyond by even a millimeter what has been foreseen in some way. The problem with depleted uranium, and this was what worried us, is that not only does it produce negative effects, as in the military sector almost everything produces negative effects, but also that it produces uncontrollable effects, which go beyond the present. That's the problem with depleted uranium. So from this point of view, something that might appear not too costly could, on the contrary, with time, become very costly.
Here we have a depleted uranium shell. Its radioactivity level is 40% less than what we can find here in this room.
The Atlantic Alliance is slow to acknowledge the use of depleted uranium weapons in the Balkans. In 2001, an official report estimates the quantities used at more than 3 tons in Bosnia and 10 tons in Kosovo. But NATO command refuses to confirm any link whatsoever between its airstrikes and any contamination. When I contacted the Allied Forces Communications Agency in Brussels, nobody was willing to answer my questions. In France, Alain Acariès is an inconsolable father. His son died in 1997 from lymph gland cancer. Ludovic was a soldier driving a truck in Bosnia. A truck that was contaminated, claims Alain Acariès, by depleted uranium dust since the Gulf War. He had his suspicions confirmed by an independent laboratory.
Mr. Acariès provided them with several samples of his son's cancerous lymph glands taken in a French hospital after his death. A powerful electronic microscope and a new technique perfected by Professor Gatti revealed the interior of the tissue.
We can clearly see the tiny particles, nanoparticles. They're not degradable nor compatible. They're not compatible with life.
Even more surprising is the chemical composition of these nanoparticles.
There is silver, chlorine, gold, magnesium and silicon, which form a very strange material that doesn't exist in nature.
You've been working on this case for 11 years and you've taken legal action. What's the situation today?
Despite what was revealed by the examination, the link with depleted uranium has been denied.
But why are you doing all this?
I want the truth to be acknowledged. I want people to accept that my son was contaminated through the fault of the army, which didn't decontaminate the trucks in the Gulf. Something has to be done. We can't just let it slide. It's been the biggest tragedy in my life.
An association, Avigulf, of which Alan Agarias is a member, has been formed to inform potential depleted uranium victims, most of whom are soldiers, and to support them in their legal battles for justice. I met the magistrate in charge of the affairs filed with the county court in Paris. But the judge, Berthelot Geoffroy, is naturally subject to rules of confidentiality. Despite the slow legal progress, Alan Acarias is still hopeful of winning the case he has lodged. Against him, the military institution remains rooted in its own convictions.
We're not unfamiliar with the debate, and we're taking it into account. But quite simply, we can observe that until now, no study, and God knows many studies have been carried out through the United Nations Environmental Programme, the World Health Organization, or by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and no study has highlighted or demonstrated any long-term harmful consequences on health or on the environment.
Are there any operational theatres where France has intervened recently where these depleted uranium weapons have been used?
No, these weapons haven't been used by France in any operational theatres. I would remind you that depleted uranium munitions are conventional weapons and recognized as such by every international convention. They're not nuclear weapons, which the word uranium could suggest.
France's position is in contradiction with efforts undertaken by the European Parliament. For years, European deputies have been calling for a moratorium on the manufacture and use of these weapons, with MEPs voting such resolutions almost unanimously. Monica Frassoni is co-president of the European Green Party.
The ongoing story began with strange events during the Gulf War, then continued and intensified with the war in Yugoslavia, and it became an almost traditional theme for the European Parliament. One important element, in my view, is that France and the UK have always refused to enforce bans and to support the moratorium on depleted uranium. Very often, we can see the extreme reticence of governments and armies, even of political forces, to raise the subject in public.
The urgent need for more concerted political action against depleted uranium is only more apparent when a new war breaks out, exposing new risks. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq. In 2003, the United States attack Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein, who continues to taunt the US despite 12 years of rigorous sanctions. At the time, I'm in Baghdad, witnessing the repeated air attacks targeting the presidential palaces with depleted uranium projectiles. It's a short-lived war. In just 3 weeks, the Americans removed the dictator. Jim McDermott is not a typical American congressman. He's one of the few who have seen war close up. As an officer, he served in Vietnam, and as a psychiatrist, he has treated some of those who survived.
Mm-hmm. This, when I was dealing,
Bush lied, because I went over to Iraq and what became Baghdad Jim, not by intention, but because I was there, and they asked me what I thought, and I said, I think he's going to mislead us to get us into war. And so then we did it to all the rest of the country. I mean, and Fallujah was the Basra of 91. Fallujah was where we used absolutely awesome power to destroy that city.
In 2004, the Americans are confronted with massive insurrection. The epicenter is Fallujah. To stem the revolt, the city is bombarded. A deluge of fire rains down with white phosphorus and depleted uranium munitions. Today, peace has been restored to the city of mosques, and life has returned under the watchful eye of the Iraqi army. At the new hospital, Dr. Samira Alan shows me the tragedy she has to face every day.
They born prematurely, and I mean before they complete their pregnancy, just less than 8 months. And one of them born with cleft lip and palate.
These babies will have surgery, right?
Of course, if he
survives.
If he survives, yes.
Yeah.
Since 2006, we start to notice that there is an abnormal increase in the incidence of congenital anomalies among the birth in our hospital. According to the cases we register, the incidence about 14.7 per thousand live birth.
What would be a normal rate of deficiency?
It should not exceed 1 or 2 per thousand. We examined 25 families from Fallujah. Those families have babies born with birth defects. We took hair sample from the kids and from the parents, and we sent these samples to an independent lab in Germany, and we found high concentration of uranium, mercury, bismuth, and other trace elements that is not usually used by human being and not naturally present in the soil or in the plants.
In Baghdad, the authorities have to take their religious leaders' opinions into account. Their voices carry weight, and their criticism is widely heard. Jawad al-Halisi is the heir to a very influential dynasty, and he protests strongly against what he sees as an attack on his people's genetic integrity.
These deformed children are the result of the use of depleted uranium. They're deformed fetuses. An international effort is required to clean up. In the same way, they brought together 30 countries and their armies under the pretext of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They should work together on a cleansing project, like with the Marshall Plan in Germany, because the sanitary situation in Iraq is catastrophic.
Unlike after the Gulf War of 1991, the U.S. Defense Department has never published figures concerning the use of depleted uranium during the war in Iraq in 2003. Unofficial estimates speak of over 2,000 tons. Since the beginning of my investigation, I've been trying to obtain a reaction from the Pentagon. After weeks of exchanging emails, a spokesman finally responds. Dear sir, we won't be able to accommodate your on-camera interview request. The scientific community have investigated the radiological safety and environmental impacts of depleted uranium for several decades. The Agency for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that it is aware of no cancers or cases of leukemia among workers or other populations that can be attributed to exposure to natural or depleted uranium. In Washington, Time magazine called Thomas Pickering the five-star general of the diplomatic corps. He was actively involved in the international mobilization against Saddam Hussein in 2001, but he openly opposed the war in 2003.
Iraqis who say, look, we came in and created a mess and we didn't resolve it all, in my view, have some justification for their position. I leave it to wise men, lawyers, and judges to tell you whether the answer to the Iraqi is we still owe them more. But if I were an Iraqi, I suppose they would say, yeah, you've got to create a perfect paradise here.
I can understand from an armament standpoint and from a strategic planning standpoint why you'd want to have the hardest and the best weapons that could just demolish anything. They're unwilling to look at the aftermath of it and what the Geneva Convention and other things say about, you know, what you leave on the ground afterward. The military is not very well known for its ability to clean up after itself.
The official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great because it's really effective and it's recyclable too. I think in that situation there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards...
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the US Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call national sacrifice zones, that we, in order to amass nuclear weapons in this country, we created very large, profound areas of contamination where we simply lack the capability and the technology to restore them to their original conditions, much less to conditions that would allow even limited uses. So these are areas that we more or less have to sacrifice in the name of nuclear deterrence.
It is by chance that I make an astonishing discovery in Iraq, which confirms Robert Alvarez's alarmist prediction. Close to Basra Airport, the broken shells of tanks destroyed in 2003 are lined up along the road. Soldiers tell me of incidents previously kept secret.
The tanks were contaminated by uranium. A team from the Environment Ministry examined them, and they confirmed the contamination. From time to time, the Americans and the British come here, and they take tanks away somewhere, transporting them further away from the airport. But we don't know what becomes of them.
But I want to know. For the contaminated scrap metal, this mysterious destination is the end of the road, and finding it would mean the end of my investigation. I decide to speak to General Jabbar, who commands the border police in the Basra region.
Some of the scrap was moved to this desert place. How do you call it?
It's called Afr el Batin.
When was it moved there?
The program was set up in 2008. To this provisional site, they've transported 150 tons of scrap metal.
What happened to the scrap when it gets there? When they bring it there, then they put it in the ground. What do they do with the scrap?
They dig and they put it in holes in the ground. They simply take it from one place to another. Obviously, it's in the desert. But according to our information, there are water tables below. Scientific reports say it's potentially dangerous for the water.
I do my utmost to get to Afr el Batin. I need an authorization and an escort. General Jabbar promises to help. But then a counter-order arrives from Baghdad. The affair is beyond his authority, and only a minister can give me the required permission. I know Iraq too well. It will never happen.
One of the things you learn as a child is clean up your own mess. Don't expect somebody else to come in here and pick up your crayons and your toys. So we did this war of choice, and my view is that we have a responsibility for the mess we leave. We can't walk away and just say, well, we don't care.
The depleted uranium question, like any question involving armies, weapons and wars, suffers from a lack of transparency, from a lack of precise democratic control on both national and European levels. I think the priority is to continue the fight on the UN level, which is very useful, and also within the European Union, so that we can obtain a moratorium on depleted uranium munitions.
Countries that have used depleted uranium weapons, quite obviously, are not interested in being raked over the coals for a weapon system they feel they have a right to use and which they feel is not dangerous. But we will see. The international community doesn't stand still on these kinds of things. And I think that if there's an increasing effort to say, look, here are the damages, and you have to have something concrete, and you have to say that this is more than a supposition, and that we have done some research, and unfortunately you have to bring examples of where beyond the pure use of depleted uranium as a tank buster, you have created a special kind of damage to the individuals beyond what normally conventional weapons create, then I think you have a basis for moving ahead.
Depleted uranium munitions were invented in the 1970s to combat Moscow's armored divisions. The Soviet enemy has disappeared, but this all-powerful arsenal has remained. Those responsible for authorizing its use will one day have to be accountable to the victims and explain why they turned a deaf ear to every appeal for caution.
The most brave people are the people who've never been to war. The ones who think war is such a great deal and want to go to the parades and stand there and see the flags go by and hear the bands. They haven't been anywhere near what it's like when they come.
That's it for this week's episode, and don't forget to share your thoughts and comments with us. Until next week and another Aperture. Goodbye.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salam and welcome to this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. So welcome, and today we have a new story. A miser has buried his gold in a secret place in his garden. Every day he went to this spot, dug up the treasure and counted it piece by piece to make sure it was all there. He made so many trips that a thief who had been observing him guessed what it was the miser had hidden, and one night quietly dug up the treasure and made off with it. When the miser discovered his loss, he was overcome with grief and despair. He groaned and cried and tore his hair. He passerby heard his cries and asked what had happened. My gold, cried the miser wildly. Someone has robbed me. Your gold? There in that hole? Why did you put it there? Why did you not keep it in the house where you could easily get it when you had to buy things? Why? Screamed the miser angrily. Why, I never touched the gold. I couldn't think of spending any of it. The stranger picked up a large stone and threw it into the hole. If that is the case, he said, cover up that stone. It is worth just as much to you as the treasure you lost. A possession is worth no more than the use we made of it. And now the continuation of Lantern.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi nasta'in. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with the views of the Islamic religion regarding accumulating wealth. It must be indicated that, wealth and money and properties are very much needed for ordinary lives. However, in the Islamic religion, we find that accumulating wealth, especially gathered in a wrong way and through oppressing others or through denying other people their own rights, will not be, this kind of acts, accumulating wealth by means of imposing all sorts of hardships on others, isn't an act endorsed in the Islamic religion. In the Holy Quran, as indicated in the Holy Quran, collecting gold and silver is abominable. The Holy Quran frowns upon collecting gold and silver. Now, when one of the companions of the sixth and fallible Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam went to him and wanted an explication of this Quranic verse, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam intended, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam explained it that by gold, it isn't meant, this gold, as a metal, as a very precious metal, that rather, this gold signifies something that annihilates one's religion. And by silver, it's meant something that comes to be the fountainhead of disbelief and not believing in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we find that, through collecting wealth and not distributing that wealth among the needy, two abominable side effects emerge. One of them is, annihilation or disappearance of one's religion. And another one is that someone becomes, the accumulator of that wealth and becomes a disbeliever in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And as someone may not believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and in the judgment day, he or she will become a tyrant. In another piece of hadith related from the first infallible Imam Amir al-Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, he mentioned that there are four kinds of drunkenness. One of them is drunkenness due to an inebriating liquid, like for example wine. And another one is drunkenness of properties. Another one is drunkenness of sleeping. And another one is drunkenness of power. Now we find that drunkenness of properties finds expression in the sense that someone has accumulated too much wealth. And at the same time, he forgets Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and imagines that his wealth will give him an everlasting life in the whole world and forgets everything.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
In another piece of hadith, someone went to Imam al-Sadiq, the sixth infallible Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, and asked him for some piece of advice. Then Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam gave him this piece of advice, that when you believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and when you know that doing good deeds is a praiseable and praiseworthy job, why should it be your practice to collect money and to accumulate money? Because accumulating money in itself isn't good unless you distribute the money, the excess money, something that you don't need other than your normal needs in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now we find that according to the first infallible Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, someone went to Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam and asked him, who will be the most deprived of all people? Then Imam Ali alayhi salam explained that someone who finds out his own properties on the records of other people, and that he himself, because of accumulating that wealth, is going to enter the hellfire. However, his ayahs will go into the paradise because of receiving that great wealth and distributing that wealth among the needy. It's indicated in one of the hadiths that when the first coins were minted, Satan came and cast a look at the first mints, at the first coins. And then Satan said, from now on, it's enough for me that people come and worship, these coins and this, financial power instead of me. Because, through love of people for accumulating wealth, they will go in the same way as I desired them to go. So we find that from this perspective, we find that gold and silver and financial power may turn into something like an idol, and accumulating wealth and not distributing it in the cause of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala turns into a kind of idol worshipping in this world. And the effects of idol worshipping in this world will be none but going into the hellfire in the world hereafter. Thank you.
that was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.